Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks so much for joining me for today's show. Really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great and safe 4th of July holiday weekend. Lots to talk about on today's show, including fireworks safety. What do we need to know to keep our kids and ourselves safe from injury? We'll also find out about some lessons learned over the past 6 months of the coronavirus pandemic. Plus, we'll learn how telemedicine and virtual visits may be changing our medical world. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us. Happy 4th of July weekend.
Yeah, same to you. Thanks, Fred.
So one of the biggest stories over this past week here in the area is the new mandatory mask order issued in both St. Louis City and St. Louis County. Here's how St. Louis Mayor Lyda Crewson made the announcement.
So one of the things that we've been talking about for weeks is masks. And yesterday, the Pandemic Task Force encouraged us, maybe even pushed us a little, to require that everybody wear a mask when you are indoors in an area of public accommodation. So retail shop, hardware store, grocery store, gas station. So today, St. Louis City and County are announcing that we are requiring all of you to do a little more. Wear a mask if you're inside in public spaces, public places. Or spaces. It's a level of precaution that the scientists and the doctors really believe will help to continue to protect us.
So, Dr. Buchholz, what's your reaction?
I applaud this. If you just look at the numbers just in St. Louis, we've had a pretty significant increase in the last couple of days, to the point kind of getting kind of the increase in what we were looking at in April when we were kind of at our first peak. So, you know, I would have applauded this earlier in the week, but I wouldn't say better late than never, but it's early enough that I think it can have an impact. But just recognize the fact that this is already, you know, we may be already entering the territory of where we are dealing with this on a more severe level than we've been in the last couple of weeks. And masks, have consistently showed to reduce the spread of this, particularly in these closed environments. I think it's worthy to say if you don't have to go, I'm not sure it's something that you need to do in a closed, tight environment. You hear in Texas and Florida, they've already kind of closed bars because things have gotten so severe. But, you know, I was driving down Manchester last night walking, as I was going home from work after rounding, and there's lots of people outside not wearing masks, and I just, it made my heart sink. I'm just like, this is just... we're asking for it. So I think it's just something we have to do, not only to prevent yourself from getting sick, but to prevent others from getting sick. It's like wearing your seatbelt. It's like making sure you're safe to go out and drive when you've been out for a while. These are just things that's good for the public good and just something we have to do to prevent a much bigger problem that affects us all. So strongly encourage it and applaud the move.
What's the best mask to wear?
You know, I don't think there's any, there's lots of things that come out here and there. I think, let me just preface, I think something's better than nothing. And I think anything that's got a good tight seal or a decent seal, you know, and covers your nose and covers your mouth is important. It doesn't have to be super tight at the N95. I don't think there's a huge difference between those incredibly tight-fitting masks compared to just a simple face mask. There's something that came out that bandanas may not be as good as everything else, but I banana still is better than nothing. The premise behind this is just basically you're at least diminishing the amount of stuff that's coming out of your mouth. It's not really meant to protect you per se, but it's when you have a certain critical mass of people in an environment that are wearing it, there's less circulation of potential virus that gets others that have not been infected yet. So, you know, I'm wearing just a paper surgical mask. It's what I wear when I see patients in the hospital. It's what I wear when I go to the grocery store. I also have a cloth mask, and I'm ordering another one just because it seems it'll be a little bit more comfortable, that I'll wear as well, too. And I'll wash it every couple of days just to make sure it's clean.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, this past week, federal health officials testified before a Senate committee, with Dr. Anthony Fauci having this scary warning.
We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around.
How scary is that?
Terrifying. You know, and again, I think a question that I pose, and I think anybody that's hearing and thinking about this poses, is just, you know, what was the point of the first 3 months of, you know, the shelter in place, or I guess 2 months, when we're having this again? And I think that's an important point, is that the follow-up policies we have not put in place, and we're starting to do that now only after the fact. And, you know, again, yes, they're doing more testing. Yes, in a lot of these places, the mortality rate's a little bit lower because a lot more younger people are affected. But, you know, I think part of this is young people aren't, you know, it's just a law of human nature that they probably don't feel the impact of this as much and feel a little bit more fearless. But it's the young people that get other people that are more vulnerable sick. And, you know, I have a patient now that got this because lots of people visit his house and they didn't seem to recognize the fact of this, even though he was concerned. And here he is sick. And hopefully he'll do well, and I think he will. But it shows how this all interconnects. This transcends race, it transcends socioeconomic status, it transcends age. You know, if there's a bunch of young people that are sick, it puts another portion of the population at risk. And if there's enough young people sick, some of them are going to die. And it's a tragedy. It's just a total, utter tragedy. And it just, you know, again, we're bracing for this next impact in St. Louis. We think it's coming. We expect it. And I think that's what Dr. Fauci is suggesting, is it's going to come across the country because pretty much everybody's done the same playbook, which is not the playbook that everybody else has followed, and we're paying for it. And it's frustrating, really frustrating.
Dr. Buchholz, I want to get your reaction to this advice from Dr. Fauci about avoiding bars.
A congregation at a bar inside is bad news. We really got to stop that right now when you have areas that are surging like we see right now.
What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely agree. And again, as I said many times before, it seems clear that where this really spreads and the really dangerous areas are in these closed areas where there's circulation about. So, you know, think of air conditioning or heating, where it just blows the virus kind of around in a swirl and just gets everybody sick. Not even just, even if you're social distance, it doesn't make much of a difference. And in this situation, face masks help. But again, if you're at a restaurant or a bar, it's hard to use a face mask and imbibe in the activity that you're at that place to do. So it just, you know, that's been a place I've avoided personally. I've tried to give patronage to a lot of restaurants, and I tip extra and make sure to try to support those workers, and I respect and want them to have jobs. But I, you know, being in a closed environment or sitting at a restaurant or a bar, I think just unless really great measures are taking place, or you're outside and great measures are taking place, it's just, I personally am not ready for it. And I think you're seeing the effect of this in Florida and Texas. It's just been, it's a catastrophe. There's no other way to explain it than say it.
This past week, Pfizer announced some preliminary results for its COVID-19 vaccine. Here's CNN's Elizabeth Cohen.
So what Pfizer did was they vaccinated 36 study subjects with their COVID vaccine, just 36. And on average, they did achieve an immune response. And that immune response was best after two doses. Now, here's another reason why we should be careful. They gave doses of varying sizes, basically. And after two medium-sized doses, 75% of the study subjects experienced fever. More than 80% had other side effects, such as headache or fatigue. Now, it was transient. The fever generally went away within a day, but still, that's something you want to keep an eye on. You could easily make an argument saying, and you could buy this argument, that a day of fever is not such a big deal. What you're getting in return is a vaccine that might help control this virus, but you have to ask, will the public accept, will they agree to get a vaccine that has a relatively high incidence of fever? Now, we don't know what the final vaccine will do. Will it give 75% of people fever? But still, you have to ask that question.
What do you make of these early results?
Well, I think, one, they're promising. And again, it's a small number of people, but it shows that it's definitely listening not only just the immune response, but the body's response to that, which is encouraging. You know, the next step with this is to start doing it on a larger group of people and then, you know, looking to see if it prevents infection. That's really the crux of any vaccine goal. And I get the point of will people be willing to tolerate a fever? And I think, you know, for things like the flu and some other vaccines, that seems to be a stumbling block for a lot of people. I'd be curious what coronavirus does, because, I mean, it certainly it's caught the national attention to the degree that none of these other diseases have. And I think the older generation listening to this may remember getting a smallpox vaccination. You know, again, smallpox was a deadly disease. That vaccination is not pleasant. I remember we did trials when I was a student, and I was too much of a chicken, but some of my friends did, because you got $600 to do it, and they were sicker than a dog for a couple of days. I mean, sick, just miserable. But you know, they're inoculated now against smallpox, which is a potentially deadly disease too, and it had been through centuries. So, you know, that it just shows the point of the vaccine is to generate an immune response, and something that's pretty vigorous, although short. But you know, we want effectiveness here, and I think I kind of understand the strategy there from Pfizer's standpoint.
The FDA, meanwhile, is saying that they want to see 50% efficacy in any possible new vaccine. Is 50% low to you?
No, not as low as you think. I'd have to go back and look at the shingles vaccine literature. It's been a while since I reviewed that, but I somewhat recall that that's the number as well, too. No vaccine's perfect. It's not going to prevent all infections. It goes back to this kind of complex interaction of what we call herd immunity and how vaccines play a role, is that if there's a certain percentage of people vaccinated, it probably serves a benefit of protecting others. And, you know, 50% of something is certainly better than 100% of something when it comes to getting infected. So it's not a super high bar, I'll admit, but I think it also shows that we're willing to trade that to get something that at least has an effect on some portion of the population that will get this. And you know, I would take a 50% reduction of 100,000 cases right now or 120,000 deaths. I mean, I'd be willing to make that trade in a second. So I think it's appropriate.
We've also heard this past week about a possible new swine flu showing up in China. How worried should we be about that?
Well, this is just, I think it's a quote-unquote lab discovery, and depending on what theory you believe about where coronavirus came from, you can kind of make your own risk assessment there. But this is not something clearly occurring in nature. It's just a strain that they noted. And you know, again, it has a potential, but, you know, how pandemics occur, too, are dependent on a lot of different factors, and it's hard to predict that as well. But it's, you know, I think it speaks to a larger, important point that, you know, we are vulnerable to viruses, particularly if they're new enough that our immune system does not have a mechanism to deal with it, and the population or across a country, a region, or the world has an immune system that can recognize it. And, you know, whether it be coronavirus, whether it be, you know, influenza or some other virus, you know, this is a reality we will continue to have, and it's frankly been throughout our entire history. And, you know, this is why we do this research. We discover this stuff to discuss it and then figure out ways to deal with this. And, you know, this is why it's important to invest in this research and pay for this. And, you know, in times of austerity, you say, well, why are we paying for this or this budget's big? But it's this basic research that's so, so important.
Dr. Buckle, lots to talk about. Thanks so much for all your time. Really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. And it's been an interesting week. So hopefully we go through the weekend and do well with this. And I'd be curious to see how numbers turn out next week. So I appreciate the platform as always.
Dr. Fred Buckle is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next, we'll talk about fireworks over this 4th of July holiday weekend. What do we need to know to keep ourselves and our kids safe? This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Each year, thousands of people are injured by fireworks, and almost half of those injured are children and teenagers. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. John Peter. Dr. Peter is a pediatric emergency physician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Dr. Peter, what concerns do you have as we're right now in the midst of the 4th of July holiday weekend?
Well, unfortunately, it's that time of year when we will see fireworks-related injuries in children. The 4th is an exciting time for children. They love the fireworks. They love to see them and experience them. And unfortunately, sometimes they're injured by them.
So what sort of injuries do you see?
Primarily burns. We see some blunt-related injuries related to the fireworks, but probably most of the stuff is burn-related.
What about eye injuries?
We do. Unfortunately, we see kids every year that have sometimes a vision-threatening or vision-destructive injury from fireworks.
What should you do if your child or you suffer some sort of an injury from a firecracker or fireworks this weekend?
I think what I would tell families is if it appears to be anything other than just a very minor sort of burn, that they seek medical attention. Sometimes especially the fireworks injuries to the eyes can be deceiving. They don't initially appear to be vision threatening, but they can be relatively serious.
But don't rub your eyes, don't rinse your eyes, don't apply pressure, just head to the ER?
I think if the eye is impacted by a fireworks, probably the best thing you can do is just simply cover the eye with a non-pressure type dressing. You don't want anything pressing on the eye, and bring the child in to be seen by an emergency medicine physician, yes.
And allay some of the fears people may be having when they hear go straight to the ER.
Well, I think in this day of COVID, people have sometimes second thoughts about coming to the emergency department. That's something to be considered when you're coming for relatively minor type conditions that could be dealt with at an urgent care or with your private doctor. But most fireworks injuries are not insignificant, and they need to be evaluated by professionals in the field.
We're talking with Dr. John Peter. Dr. Peter is a pediatric emergency physician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Dr. Peter, what types of fireworks or firecrackers are the most dangerous for kids?
The ones that we probably see the most serious injuries are associated with sort of explosive-type devices, large firecrackers, explosive devices like that. They seem to be the most destructive in terms of things like loss of digits or loss of extremities, significant facial or eye injuries.
What about sparklers?
We can. I mean, for the longest time, sparklers were felt to be sort of that safe fireworks that the little kids could hold and spin around and enjoy. But they get to be incredibly hot. The sparkler itself reaches a temperature of somewhere around, I believe it's 1,800 degrees. So you can sustain a fairly serious burn very quickly with a improperly held sparkler.
I think a lot of parents or kids think, oh, that'll never happen to me. But as an ER physician, you do see it happening to almost everyone.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that, yes. I mean, that's something you hear time and again. I just didn't think this would happen to my child. But it does. I mean, it does. It's like so many things. You know, you can't take your eyes off your kids too long. They're inquisitive little creatures. They want to see. They want to do, learn about things. And sometimes they do things without a whole lot of experience, and it gets them injured.
What advice do you have for parents to protect themselves and their kids if they're somewhere where there are fireworks being shot off this weekend?
Well, I think so much of the stuff we see is just sort of common sense behavior around fireworks. If somebody throws a firecracker out onto the ground, don't pick it up. I mean, if it doesn't explode, just leave it be. So often we have children, you know, walk up and grab a lit firecracker and then it blows up in their hand. Don't be part of a group of people that might be using like bottle rockets or Roman candles to shoot at each other. That's a sort of typical mechanism where children are injured in the face or in the eyes. Someone shoots a bottle rocket or the bottle rocket fails to go off after it's been lit, and then the child looks at the bottle rocket in the little tube and it goes off and strikes them in the face. So, just maintain a healthy distance from these. You can enjoy the fireworks if you're a safe distance away and the fireworks are being launched by responsible individuals in a responsible way.
Dr. Peter, since I've got you here on the phone and you're an emergency room physician, wanted to get your reaction to those new mandated mask orders that are now in place for both St. Louis City and St. Louis County. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think you hate to say common sense because some people might be offended by saying that. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I mean, you know, this is a virus that we have appears to be transmitted via, you know, when we sneeze, when we cough, when we speak to each other, you know, respiratory droplets, that's aerosols, that sort of thing. And it's, you know, it's a very simple thing to put a mask on. I mean, it's become really just sort of second nature around here. We all wear masks in the emergency department when we deal with our patients, and we ask that the patients wear masks when they come to see us. It's not a huge burden, and it really could make a huge difference in terms of the spread of this virus.
And masks both prevent and protect?
Yes, correct. Yeah, it does. And again, they're not... Some people seem to find them very intrusive. I mean, I think the thing that I find maybe the most troublesome about the mask is I just enjoy talking to my patients. I enjoy, you know, seeing the look on their face, you know, the children smiling, that sort of thing. And you kind of lose that with the mask. Sometimes you have to speak up a little louder, too, because of the mask. But, I mean, it's a small, small price to pay for preventing, you know, the COVID or, you know, to spread the COVID to somebody else.
Does it make a difference what type of mask we wear?
In certain situations, it does. There are guidelines as far as the situation you find yourself in, whether or not you're in a, you're in close contact with someone with known or strongly suspected, COVID. As opposed to just if you go to the grocery store and you know, where you can usually get by with just a simple cotton mask or a simple surgical facial mask, as opposed to the, you know, the N95s that we use in the situations where we're more concerned about, you know, direct contact with somebody with the virus.
Good deal. Hey, doctor, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay, sure.
Dr. John Peter is a pediatric emergency medicine physician at SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Coming up, it's been about a half year now since coronavirus hit the United States. What lessons have we learned since then? This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. We'll talk about that next on Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. It's been about 6 months now since the coronavirus has caught hold in the United States. What lessons have we learned since then? Let's talk about that with Dr. Ankit Nahata, Dr. Nahata is an ICU physician at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. Nahata, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Fred, for having me.
So let's talk about some of the lessons that have been learned. What do you think we've learned?
So when we started, Fred, we were very worried about the risk of infection to staff, to other patients. Now that we've experienced this for a few months, we know that personal protective equipment works. Even though several of St. Mary's nurses and a couple of physicians have tested positive, it has been a small number, and the overwhelming number of nurses and doctors taking care of high-risk COVID patients have actually done okay. The staff has really gotten better at personal protective equipment, donning and doffing PPE. We have learned a lot in terms of the management, but at the same time, there's a lot which is we still don't know. In terms of medications, what works for COVID, there have been several medications which were promising in the early trials, but which have failed to show significant result, and we have started to move away from them. There have been some medications which we see has been working in the big trials done recently, which we have started using, remdesivir, steroids. They have shown good promise, and we still need to see more data. We have also getting good results with convalescent serum, which is basically plasma from patients who have had COVID and have recovered, and their plasma contains antibody. And we use this plasma and give them to the patients who are sick with COVID and who are on oxygen, who are clinically worsening, and we have seen that the patients have responded to that. At the same time, there's a lot about the disease which we still don't know. We have seen that the disease affects a lot of the organ systems. Initially, we were more concerned about the disease affecting the lungs, but now that we have had experience with the disease, we have seen that the disease can affect a lot of the organ systems in the body. We have seen the kidneys being affected, the brain being affected, patients getting strokes, patients having clotting disorders. Now we are much more aware about these, and we are starting therapy earlier and detection sooner. In terms of how we have learned to cope with it, we've also, our facilities have undergone remodeling. We have more capabilities to put ventilators in non-ICU rooms, just planning for a surge. Our plan operations guys have helped tremendously. We have increased the number of negative pressure rooms which are needed to treat these patients. And overall, we have gotten much more prepared to handle a second surge.
You mentioned ventilators. Have you changed the way you use ventilators in patients?
Absolutely. That's a great question, Fred. Initially, when the patients presented in America, we were very worried about the risk of infection to staff and other patients. And based on the data from Italy and China, we were actually putting patients on the ventilator sooner to avoid concerns for transmission to other patients. But we noted that the patients, when we put them on the ventilator sooner, actually did worse. We were avoiding therapies like mask ventilation, high-flow oxygen, mostly for concerns for transmission. But now that we have had more experience and we have actually started to use these therapies so we can avoid putting patients on the ventilator, now we have gone from putting patients on the ventilator very early to delaying the ventilator as much as possible. So it's actually been a complete 180 turn.
Have you seen an improvement in getting tests done quicker and faster and more often?
Absolutely. When this started, we had very limited number of tests, and we had to really push for our patients to get tested, justify, because our testing capability was very limited. And when we were able to get that test done, it used to take days. So from there, we have come to a point where we are actually testing much more, and our turnaround time has reduced to hours from days. We have gotten much better at testing patients, and we are testing more patients, even low-risk patients who are getting surgeries, elective procedures. We have started testing them. So the testing availability has increased tremendously, and that's been a very good thing for us.
What have we learned about the symptoms of coronavirus? How has that changed over 6 months?
So we have learned more about the disease, and we have seen that the symptoms can actually be a huge spectrum. The common symptoms being more common, like other viral infections, the upper respiratory symptoms, the cough. What has been prominent compared to other viral infections is that loss of taste and the loss of smell. And that's a very sensitive symptom for COVID. We have also seen that COVID can present in a multitude of other ways. We have seen patients presenting with strokes, presenting with kidney failure. We have noted that the patients can present in a very wide spectrum of disease. And so we have become much more cautious in ruling out COVID. And if patients are even at low risk, we are testing them. And we have seen patients who actually were presenting with infection in UTI, with strokes, testing them as the testing availabilities have increased, have shown that they have COVID. All the data is showing that COVID can affect multiple organ systems, not just the lungs.
We're talking with Dr. Ankit Nahata. Dr. Nahata is an ICU physician at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. Nahata, what worries you the most about the coronavirus at this point?
So what concerns me the most is the fact that if we let our guards down, we can experience a surge in the cases. Even though cases are stable in the St. Louis region, if we stop paying attention to hand hygiene, wearing masks, this can come back. It's not a question of if we'll have a second surge, it's a question of when. A second surge is inevitable.
And how important is it to wear a mask?
I think the importance of wearing a mask cannot be overstated. This is the one easy way where we can reduce transmission by significant number.
What's your advice for us on this 4th of July weekend?
We have to continue doing the social distancing, wearing the mask and good hand hygiene, avoiding crowded places. People have been experiencing cabin fever, and it's natural for people to go out, but we may be done with coronavirus. The coronavirus is not done with us. So if we let our guards down, this can be dangerous for the community.
How concerned are you about asymptomatic transmission of this virus?
So there has been a lot of conflicting data about asymptomatic transmission. Even CDC and WHO has put out information and retracted them. I still am concerned about asymptomatic transmission. It has been shown that most of the transmission happens before you really get symptomatic. And that's why it's really important to wear a mask. You know, once you're sick, you know to avoid places. Most people will avoid going out in crowded areas. But there's a concern that the majority of the transmission actually happens before you get really sick. So even though we don't know all the data about asymptomatic transmission, and we'll have to wait for more studies, but I think we should take asymptomatic transmission seriously. And that, again, means wearing masks and avoiding crowded places.
Dr. Nahata, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much, Fred.
Dr. Ankit Nahata is an ICU physician at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Coming up, we'll take a look at the impact of telehealth during this coronavirus pandemic. Are you more likely now to seek a virtual visit in the days ahead? This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Telehealth, telemedicine, virtual visits all have been booming during this coronavirus pandemic. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Christina Anderson. Dr. Anderson is a family medicine physician with the SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
What's been the impact of telehealth over the past few months?
Well, it's really allowed us to stay in touch with patients and bridge that gap between in-office visits and still continue care for a lot of chronic disease, sometimes acute conditions, and really maintain that relationship between your doctor, your healthcare provider, and you so that you feel like you're still being well cared for and you can access the services that you need.
How has telehealth changed the way you work with patients?
Well, it's definitely opened up a lot of flexibility for us. It's been actually really cool to see how people are embracing the technology and being able to make their schedules flexible and work with a lot of the different appointment slots. And you can access your healthcare provider from your work on a break or your lunch break. You can do it from home. It's increased our flexibility in clinic as well so that we can offer you a visit without being, you know, having to come in the office, which has been super neat. And it's really opened up a lot of cool technology opportunities as well.
Are some types of cases better to be treated over telehealth than in person?
Yes, there are certain things that you should probably be seeing in the office for, where we would need to listen to your heart and lungs or push on your belly. But there are some things that can be really well treated over telehealth. Mood follow-ups are really great. There are some kind of wellness things that you can tinker with. Some of them you need a full physical exam. There's at least some things that you can at least discuss with your doctor first, and then if they figure out, you know, maybe we should bring you in, you could do that at a later date. But at least allows you to do some of that, what we call triaging, which means we talk to you about your problem and then figure out next steps at least. Lots of other chronic stuff. I frequently will do blood pressure follow-ups if you have a blood pressure cuff at home. So that works pretty nicely. And oftentimes people's blood pressure is lower at home than it is in the office because there's not that pressure of coming in. So we've been able to do some of that type of stuff too.
Are there any concerns about the use of telehealth?
Well, I think as long as people's expectations are set up front about what we can and can't do over telehealth, and that you always have the caveat, the exception of you may need to be seen in the clinic. So if we warn you about that up front, I think that's the only potential problem we've run into is that, hey, you know, turns out this isn't a good way to do this. So most people have been super flexible about that, but otherwise I don't see a lot of problems as we've kind of figured out a lot of security issues. Initially, there was some stuff about Zoom getting crashed. You've heard about, you know, work meetings and stuff that happening too, but we've really nailed it, I think, by now using the MyChart facility. So if you get your MyChart sign up, which we've made it a lot easier to do that, then you can really use that to securely do the telemedicine, the telehealth with your provider.
Explain the SSM Health MyChart.
So MyChart is an awesome way to keep in contact with your provider. You can send messages back and forth. You can see your lab results. You can schedule appointments. We've opened up a lot of scheduling possibility with that. We're actually going to be able to have people sign up for MyChart and schedule new patient appointments. But it's an awesome way to keep in touch with your doctor and get a lot of things done. You can see your health record and really take charge of your own healthcare.
We're talking with Dr. Christina Anderson. Dr. Anderson is a family medicine physician with the SSM Health Medical Group about telehealth and how it's helped so much since this COVID-19 pandemic has taken place. Dr. Anderson, what's the future for telehealth?
Well, I'm hoping that insurance continues to cover it, and they may change to covering it for only certain types of visits, like mood follow-ups that work really well for that. But I hope that we can expand it and that we can offer it to more people for more reasons in the appropriate setting. So I'm hopeful that insurance will still cover it. That's kind of the biggest hiccup I would see going forward. It's not necessarily from a provider standpoint. It would be making sure that it was covered from an insurance standpoint, because most patients I've talked to have really enjoyed that option. Sometimes it takes a couple tries or a couple kinks have to be worked out with technology because, you know, it's technology. But we've been pretty successful with it. So I'm hoping that we can continue to expand it and it'll continue to be covered.
And Dr. Anderson, go over again which kind of cases would work out well with a telehealth visit and which ones should involve an office visit.
Generally speaking, mood follow-ups work the best if you have mood concerns, depression, anxiety, attention issues, that kind of thing, sleep problems, something where I don't necessarily have to listen to your heart and lungs or push on your belly, or if it's a routine chronic disease follow-up where you don't necessarily need labs, so like a routine blood pressure follow-up where you have a blood pressure cuff at home so that your doctor can make decisions about what to do with your medicines if you need them, or routine diabetic follow-ups where you don't need a foot exam or labs or anything like that. Some doctors are even offering to do the visit and then have you come in for labs as a walk-in anyway. So when in doubt, definitely talk to your provider about what type of visit, if it's an option for you, and they'll tell you what they're comfortable with. Other common things would be like UTIs if you've had them a lot, or allergy concerns. Those are the most common ones.
Dr. Anderson, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Dr. Christina Anderson is a family medicine physician with the SSM Health Medical Group. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.